Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. You can get in touch with me through Twitter at InsideEd, by email insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. My name is Sean Delaney, and if you're an educator with a story to tell or an event to highlight, please contact me and I'll do my best to feature it on a future programme. On this week's programme, I bring you the second part of my interview with Dr. Andy Burke, who retired some years ago from St. Patrick's College from Condra, where he was Dean of Education. Andy's background is in the history and philosophy of education, and he's particularly interested in teaching and teacher education. On last week's programme, I spoke to Andy Burke about how he became a teacher educator, about how teachers learn to teach, and on whether or not teaching is a profession. On this week's programme, we discuss what Andy has been doing since retiring from his position as teacher educator in St. Patrick's College, his work in developing countries, his views on education policy, and on being a teacher educator. I began by asking Andy to tell me about the work he's been doing outside Ireland since he retired.
Well, it's not only since I retired. In fact, long before I retired, as I told you earlier, I wanted to work in developing countries. I'm thankful to God that finally I got there, and I've now worked in about 13 different developing countries in Africa, or most of the Irish Aid priority countries in Asia, in India, the Philippines, Vietnam, and most in Tajikistan for about 4 or 5 years, and most recently, the past 5-6 years, I've been working in Palestine, the West Bank, Gaza, and Egypt. And it's incredibly satisfying and fulfilling work, because these are areas of great need, and being able to help them is an absolute privilege. But one has to go in being very much aware of what one can and cannot do. And I'm always reminded, and I've never forgotten reading this statement of Paulo Freire. He says, "Remember, you cannot parachute excellence from one country or one education into another. It's got to be created from within by those who know the culture and understand the context." So I'm always reminding myself, walking into a new country, that I'm at the same disadvantage as an American walking into Ireland, trying to understand what we say on the lines, and particularly what we say between the lines. And so one should never go in with ready-made solutions. Be aware of one's limitations, but also of what one has to offer. If one has seen approaches being successful and being failures in many different countries, including your own, then you have a huge amount to offer them. But I always begin with developing countries when I meet the officials, saying, "I have no answers to your questions. I have no solutions to your problems. I have many things to say to you when I see what you're proposing. But finally, it's your country, it's your education system, you've got to make the decisions." And from once you clear that hurdle and show that fundamental respect for them, and I believe in that, then one can argue with them and argue. And I've argued right up to an assistant ministerial level and with the minister, saying, "You're going down a road, and my professional advice to you is don't go there. It has failed elsewhere. But it's your country, it's your education system, and it's your prerogative to make a decision, and I totally respect it." The Palestinian Authority, they took over education in 1994, and by 2006 they had developed a complete curriculum from grades 1 to 12. No, it wasn't perfect. But before that they had an Egyptian curriculum in Gaza, they had a Jordanian curriculum in the West Bank. But in about 10, 12 years, they had that developed with textbooks and so on. Now, they're revisiting it, and they desperately need to revisit it. But that's the kind of ambition they have. So our job is to point them in the right direction and keep flashing a red light if they're going in the wrong direction. And keep doing that until they say, always remind them, "It's your country, look. I'm an outsider."
And is your work generally in the policy area in these countries?
We deal with ministry, and that's very satisfying too, because you're within the arena where the critical decisions are made, and that's a great place to be. So it's policy, and in Palestine at the moment, we have been involved now for about 4 years in a pilot project on teacher education, which has two strands to it. One is the teaching practicum, developing that, extending it from 4 weeks, we extended it to 14 weeks, but also developing it as an integrated part of an integrated programme. Now, that part of it is still a challenge and a huge challenge for them. And we're now, as we're going to scale, we're now targeting that. And also advising them that they've got to accredit all programs by international standards. So that we get rid of a lot of the chaff, prevent the overproduction of teachers. And the other program then we're involved in is training teachers who really are underqualified. Either they didn't have a university degree or they didn't have a teaching qualification. And we're putting on a program for them to get them a teaching qualification and to turn them from being subject teachers into grade 1 to 4 teachers of integrated curriculum. That's very difficult for them because subject teaching, even down to that level, has been the modus operandi up to now. But it's amazing how they have taken to it and how ambitious they are about it and the progress they've made in a short time.
And with you working at the policy area, do you get much of a chance then to see how policy is seeping and filtering into the classes?
Always. I would never work just at the policy area. You've got to see and always see what's happening at the coalface. And we always visit schools, we talk to student teachers, we see teachers teaching all the time. And one has to be patient because they're introducing technology now into education. And in many countries I've worked in, technology has been treated as the holy grail. It'll solve all teacher education problems, you know, all teaching problems and learning problems. And I keep saying to them, look, technology is a tool. And if the teacher is the agent that has to use the tool. If you don't develop the agent, you're wasting your time. Technology will be no good. It's like giving excellent tools to somebody who wasn't a carpenter. But in spite of that, it's very hard to persuade some of the funding agencies that is the case. And teacher education has been a neglected area in most developing countries up to now. They say, let's put it into books. Let's put it into technology. Let's put it into the tools. But the agent can't operate the tools. I've seen books locked away down in Mindanao. They were shown, taken out of a metal case. There were no finger marks in them. None of them. You find computers locked up in boxes because they can't service them. Now, in Palestine, they're beginning to use it, but very often, and one has to understand this, they use it as a replacement for the blackboard. Okay, that's okay for now. That's where we all began. But they are also using it, very interestingly so, to share videos of their teaching, to submit all their homework. These are people who are never trained. These are teachers who have been teaching for years. And to contact the faculty. In Gaza, all the young teachers, mostly girls, are using the technology to talk to each other, to talk to faculty all the time, which is exactly what you want. So they have created communities of practice, which is absolutely marvellous. In many ways, better than we've done in our own country.
And what do you think then that Ireland can learn from what is done in other countries, including developing countries?
I've come to realise, rather than learn, the sheer importance of education. You're at the coalface of human living, really. And it's a great place to be. You will never become a millionaire there. But if you want motivation, you're dealing with human beings. You're dealing with people who are self-creating themselves. You're dealing with issues too that will lead into successful economies. But that should never be the limit of what education is about. So the challenge then is to meet all of those in a developing country context where resources are very scarce and where development has been very retarded up to now.
If we come back to the Irish situation then, and we look at the different people involved in education, whether it's the Department of Education and Skills, the Teaching Council, the teacher unions, teachers practicing in their classrooms, given your breadth of teacher education colleges as well, given your breadth of experience of the system now, where do you think education policy comes from?
It's difficult to know. And very often, while it was our Ministry of Education mightn't admit it, we borrow from overseas. Like the new curriculum in Ireland, the so-called new curriculum 1971, followed the Plowden Report in 1967. We borrowed payment by results as well from them back in the 19th century. And I hope we don't borrow too much from them in this whole competencies area.
In the United Kingdom you're thinking of now?
No, I borrow from Europe. Because the competencies is a tsunami coming at us from from a lot of European and OECD countries, where you boil down everything to a series of competencies, measurable competencies. And the tendency is, well, measure those because they're easy to measure, even though you might say, as the OECD report said in 2005, there are bigger things than education. But having said that, they said, well, measure what we can measure. I would say, okay, do that, but don't ever forget that what you've measured is not the heart and soul of education. So where the policy comes from, I think a lot of it is borrowed from overseas as well. But I think it's good that we've had a native good sense and common sense and a native commitment to education that I has withheld the worst of its effects and hopefully will keep them at bay for as long as we can. So we've got to play the competencies game. And Johnny Coolan said this while trying to steer it towards what is best in education. And that's good advice.
How did you manage to combine teaching and research in your time in St. Pat's?
With difficulty, because in teacher education, time is very busy. Preparing lectures will take all the time that God gives. I was trying to care for family as well, with four children. I was trying to repair a house, which I'm still working on after 40 years, and I bought it in bad repair, a very, very old house. Trying to do it, I did it, I suppose, sometimes on family time. I did it weekends because I didn't play golf, I didn't sail, I didn't do all these things because that would take me away from family. So I just gave it a lot of time. I worked very long hours. People are talking about the hours teacher educators work. They work at the number of hours you lecture. When I look back, my average week was about 60, 65 hours. It went up to 80, 90 hours. It went down maybe to 50. And all my colleagues, most vast majority of my colleagues were the same. And that's the price you have to pay to do a lot of research. Now, I think one of the regrettable things at the moment is that those in teacher education are so busy that they have very little time to do this. And I think our audience is our students. But we have a much bigger audience out there in Ireland, the audience of teachers in Ireland and beyond Ireland. We should be doing research. We should be letting them benefit from the wisdom of our research and the wisdom of our work. But it's becoming extraordinarily difficult to do that, or to find time to do it.
One of the areas of your research is around the shape of initial teacher education. What do you make of the latest changes now to how teachers are prepared at primary level?
It certainly is a move in the right direction, and I had been advocating it for at least 20 years before I retired. Now, unfortunately, not enough was done, in spite of warnings that if we don't reform education off our own bat, that it will be reformed from outside with very blunt instruments. And the kinds of things I was advocating was the integration of programmes, because the two major, largest programmes in the two largest colleges were run on the concordant model, where the academic subjects and the professional subjects really, by and large, didn't meet. And the research done in Ireland and elsewhere showed that wasn't working, in spite of the belief that it should work. And one very important longitudinal study, which I was involved in with Vincent Greeney and Father Joe McCann, looked at graduates of St. Patrick's College over their first 5 or 6 years of teaching. And we knew what they had majored in, what subject they had majored in, Irish, English and mathematics. And we asked the inspectors, who did not know what they had majored on, to evaluate their teaching of those subjects. And lo and behold, we found that there was no significant difference between those who had majored in those subjects and those who hadn't. Now, there are two possible explanations of that. One is that anybody coming into primary teacher education is very bright anyway and would have a good Master of Maths, and should have anyway. The other explanation, and Mary Kennedy, who did a similar study in the States, she gave, was that because the academic subject areas or academic faculty never addressed the issue of pedagogical content knowledge to connect what they were doing with classrooms. They never felt the need to do it. And they didn't do it. And to the best of my knowledge, they still are not doing it. And so in spite of the fact that we had superb academic departments. And they didn't do it when all the faculty in academic departments were actually former teachers. Now most of them have not been teachers. So it's much more difficult to do it. But it's been done elsewhere. It's been done in Finland, where the academic faculty member teaches both the content knowledge and the pedagogical content knowledge. We're beginning to do it even in Palestine. And the consultant institution for the project is doing it. The Canterbury Christ Church University is doing it. And we're sending over some critical faculty people to see them doing it. And so they're crossing that divide, pedagogical content knowledge, which has been there now from the mid-1980s. Lee Shulman was the first to write about it, but in fact he was the co-originator of it. The other person was Dr. Mar Hashway of Birzeit University in Palestine. Shulman wrote about it in 1986. Mar Hashway did his doctoral dissertation on it, under Shulman, in 1985. So they are the co-originators of this notion. But that notion is goes far back even to Greek times, the notion of practical wisdom, phronesis, leading to a techne, where you've got to develop the skill to operate in a situation where there aren't ready-made answers. Others have picked it up called connoisseurship. William James said in his famous talk to teachers around 1890, knowledge of psychology will not make you a better teacher. You've got to develop the sense and the ingenuity to apply that when the pupils are in front of you. In this, psychology won't help you in the least. That's pedagogical content knowledge as well. And that's a whole new development, which the colleges are taking that on now. They're bridging the gap between theory and practice. The connective tissue is being put there. So I think that's a very, very good thing. The problem is that too many things are happening too quickly and are being forced too quickly and being forced from outside, because many of these things were being advocated from inside the colleges long before they happened. But unfortunately, I think we didn't do enough about it to show where the future would lie. And it was all happening outside the country in a major way since about the 1980s. A massive literature, huge amount of research was happening, but we didn't change quickly enough at that time. But it's great that it's happening now. It's moving in the right direction, and I'm sure there will be a lot of hiccups along the way, and a lot of people will have to work very hard to make it work.
What did you like most and what did you like least about being a teacher educator?
I loved everything about being a teacher educator, with one exception: reading examinations. Every year I ended up with about 1,600 or 1,700 scripts, partial scripts. And giving every one of them 10 minutes would take me about 37, 8-hour days to read them. I never get migraine, but I used to get migraine. But what really motivated me hugely was the notion of education that I mentioned earlier. The other thing that motivated me was that I was conscious of the impact for good that I could have on the large audience in front of me. But the impact, if I got anything right, but the impact for good I could have on the massive audience that I could reach through the audience in front of me. So every year, for instance, I would teach courses to about 13 to 1400 students. Now, if you multiply each of those by 25 students per year, say for 30 years, you have 1 million people. So when I looked at them, I saw 1 million people. And I said, I've got to work hard, to do something worthwhile, to sow some ideas here that will go, the ripple effect will go way, way beyond this. That was hugely satisfying and still is hugely satisfying.
Would you recommend a son or daughter of your own to enter teaching today?
I think I would, yes. I would. I think it's a wonderful occupation. If you take it on in its fullness, and if you're allowed to take it on in its fullness, and you're not tied down to being measured every week on what they have achieved, if you're allowed to educate the whole child rather than just the child's head, And that's particularly through a primary level. I think it's a wonderful profession to be in if you take it on fully and if you're well prepared to take it on in all its richness. Otherwise, it becomes incredibly narrow. It becomes a job and you can desiccate in that kind of job. And the more the job is policed, the more you will say, well, this is not the rich profession I wanted to get into. If you're allowed to act as a professional in it and realise that every hour you make all these decisions and that they are critical decisions for the people about whom you make them and for their parents. And some of them, we can all think back. One just simply has to think back to your best teachers. You can never thank them enough. They open windows in your head to history, to philosophy, to mathematics, to whatever it was. The teacher that taught me, the nun that taught me in primary school in Bandon Convent is still alive. I still remember her. The warmth that oozed out from her, the encouragement, was incredible. Now, to be able to do that as a teacher for somebody else is a great way to live.
And if we go back to that nun in Bandon or to any of the other teachers you had in primary or post-primary education, what do you remember from your own primary and post-primary experience as a student?
I don't have good memories, Sean. Interestingly, apart from that nun, her name was Sister Alphonsus, just in case she ever listens to this, because I'm forever grateful to her. I did not have any other really inspiring teacher at primary, sadly to say. I lived in one of the most historic towns in the country, a walled town, which was taken over after the Battle of Kinsale, within 100 yards of the wall. We were never once taken out of the school to walk the town of Bandon. I was in my 20s before I got historical documents to find out about it. Secondary school, I have one great memory of one teacher, a mathematics teacher, who broke all the rules of teaching. There was bedlam in the class all the time, but we absolutely loved mathematics. He broke the rules, he put on extra classes, and we all went to them. So there are different ways. There is no one rigid way of teaching.
But how did you learn if there was bedlam in the classroom?
Because we were so attracted to mathematics. The way he posed problems, he says, here is the problem now. I'll give you one hint. The Battle of Clontarf, 1014 was the answer. And he had us all working like hell at it. And that was his approach. It was really activity learned in a very traditional setting. He was so involved in it himself. And really, isn't that the secret to teach? You can teach any subject. If you're turned on by it yourself, or if you go into it deeply enough yourself, you will be turned on by it. And you infect your students in that kind of way. At third level, I had one absolutely marvellous teacher who arrived in UCD in my last year. That was Father Fergal O'Connor. He was teaching philosophy. And he was really engaging with the questions. And he'd have your back against the wall with the questions. He had you struggling with the issues. And I only wished that I had had him for the whole 3 years. We learned a lot of philosophy, but we learned it almost like theoretical stuff. Here we were doing it. And he turned me on particularly to that. And in a way, I learned the way of handling philosophy. Later in life as philosophy and philosophy of education, to do it in that kind of way, to always connect it to reality, connected to the chalk face, connected to the reality of people's lives and the challenges of people's lives and the huge questions they ask. To do that, I actually had no exam in the final year in philosophy. I stopped giving an exam because I thought it was inappropriate. But I had him do two things. I had him do an essay and I had him keep a journal from the first day of the course, and promising them that we would read their essays and mark them. We didn't read the journal, and the journal could only put up the mark. But the journals were absolutely fantastic. But then I taught the course in such a way that nobody could ever Google it. And I started with the whole mystery, threw them into the whole mystery of cosmology and where we are in the cosmos, and nobody would ever find us, and all the big questions about God and everything else. And in the journal, some of them wrote back, this course wrecks my head, at the beginning. And others said, well, why did other people, I've been in education before, and nobody ever asked these questions? And it was interesting then, through the journals, one could see how they developed as I moved from asking the big questions, throwing them in at the deep end, and then moving into philosophy, moving into the stories that we have told to try and understand the human situation. And each story has implications for education. So then I made my way down to so-called traditional education and progressive education in that way. So I was heading for the classroom. And by doing that, I was both educating them and preparing the future teacher, showing them the connections between philosophy and actual teaching. And using, ending up particularly with John Dewey, who did that so very well. That's the way I handled it. I'm sure there are many other ways of doing it, but I felt that an exam was inappropriate for that kind of exercise. So I put them through an experience of actually doing philosophy rather than teaching a philosophy to them, you know.
When I mentioned to people, Andy, that I was going to be interviewing you, the one thing they all talked about was your enthusiasm. How have you managed to remain so enthusiastic and so passionate for education after all these years?
Because there is so much involved in it, and there is so much potential for doing good for other people, either in Ireland or elsewhere, for opening up windows in their minds, for initiating them into the human conversation, for challenging them particularly, for shaking them out of their certainties, and in a way, out of black and white answers, and getting them to deal with the mystery of life, which is much, much bigger, much more challenging. It's an area like we'll probe from the cradle to the grave, but at the end of that, between philosophers, theologians, scientists, we'll only be scratching the surface of the mystery. And by doing that, I think one will take off the blinkers, widen the whole horizon, and say, look, that's the arena. And at the end, I always said to my students, if that bothers you, just sit back and enjoy the show. It is a wonderful show to look at, the mystery of life, because, you know, there is not 100% answer to any of the questions we ask. And education is fundamentally the realisation of that fact, and then coming up with one's own answers and comparing them with the answers that other people have arrived at. That has kept me going and still keeps me going, because I, to be honest, Sean, I have no intention whatsoever of retiring.
And that's a good thing, because Andy Burke still has so much to offer education in Ireland and beyond. Well, that's where we bring this week's Inside Education to a close. Thanks to my guest, Andy Burke, for his time. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event in a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Remember, you can listen to over 200 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.